I will go ahead and call our third case on our oral calendar, A250211, in the matter of the welfare of children of AR and FF. Good morning to council. While you're getting settled, go ahead and have a seat. Thanks. Just a reminder, you'll each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Council for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The podium does adjust up and down by some buttons at the front there. Before beginning your argument, please identify your name and the party that you represent. With that, council for appellant, whenever you're ready, you may proceed.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ann Morris Carlson, and I am appointed to represent appellant Father FF in the appeal of his termination of parental rights. We are asking that this court would reverse the district court's order terminating his parental rights and remand for proper findings. If I'm unclear at all in my appellant brief, my main concern in this case is finding of fact number 9. And that finding serves the function of incorporating the entirety of the petition into the district court's findings of fact by reference. But as I ruminate on this case in the month and a half since submitting the reply brief, the less convinced I am that it matters if finding of fact number 9 is a clearly erroneous finding. And I say that because this court has to look to whether or not the district court has issued findings of fact that support the statutory basis.
Well, let me have you stick with your argument just for a minute about fact finding number 9. You know, as I think this case would be different if the district court's order had just said, Father has defaulted on this proceeding, therefore the allegations in the petition are deemed admitted or being deemed proven. And that's, we don't have that here. And as I apply HDG to the petition and the order, the district court received evidence, including testimony from two witnesses. At least one of those witnesses testified that the facts alleged in the petition were true and correct. The district court found that testimony credible. So why, even if we're sort of merging into what I think your next argument was going to be, why isn't that sufficient for this court to determine that the district court did not make any clearly erroneous findings and that the evidence supports the decision to terminate parental rights?
Because the court has to make findings of conditions that exist at the time of the trial. And the petition was filed in April, and the trial was in December. So even if we have a social worker that says, I didn't write this petition, a different social worker did, but I'm pretty sure that it's true, based on my conversations with her, I don't think that she lied, and I don't think that she did either, just so we're clear. What happened between April and December? Do we have findings? Do we have evidence of what's going on at the trial other than Dad showed up to the last hearing and he didn't show up to this one? Therefore, what we alleged back in April is true.
Did either of the witnesses provide any testimony as to any events between the filing of the petition and the December 10th hearing?
The court will have to forgive me. To the best of my recollection, the social worker testified she was unsuccessful in reaching father. She testified she was appointed to the case 2 months prior to trial. She had attempted to reach out, and she was unable to get a hold of him. And I don't think the facts really are in dispute here. I think what's really in dispute is the application of Rule 18 of the Minnesota Rules of Juvenile Protection Procedure, and also what is the reason that I struggle with my own argument coming to this court today is even if finding of fact number 9 is not a clearly erroneous finding, and to be clear, that's the argument before the court, that's the argument I made in both of my briefs. I know I made that argument. But even if it's fine, we still need clear and specific findings that tell me, the court, and most importantly, father, here's what happened. Here's what we know. Here's the reasoning. I mean, if a respondent's brief, respondent beautifully addresses Minnesota Statute 260C.301 sub 1B2, neglect of parental duties, and how that applies here. Had that analysis made its way into the court order, this would be a very different case.
So my concern then, counsel, is that what I hear is you raising an issue that perhaps wasn't fully raised in your brief. That seems like a different, what your concern you're expressing today is there were not sufficient factual findings to support the termination. Seems different than the more limited argument that I think you made in your brief, which was either about factual finding number 9 or about efforts to reunify the family.
Well, the second argument in my brief is that the findings are insufficient. It's in there. It's the second part of the brief. I mean, my argument is that these findings are insufficient to effectuate appellate review based on number 9 and 12 being erroneous findings. But whether they're erroneous findings or not, I'm still arguing that this order is insufficient to effectuate appellate review. That's my argument. That hasn't changed. Whether finding of 9 and 12 are right or wrong, we don't have an order that contains clear and specific findings that conform with the statutory criteria. I can't read these 12 factual findings and figure out which findings support which statutory basis for termination.
Can I ask you about you argued earlier that finding of fact number 9 is clearly erroneous because, well, it doesn't support the district court's order to terminate parental rights because it, in saying that the facts contained in the TPR petition have been proven, that is conditions as they existed at the time of the petition, not at the time of the hearing. But then finding of fact number 10 is that father is not able now or likely to be able in the reasonably foreseeable future to parent the child. So, I mean, that's a contemporaneous finding. How do you respond to that in terms of the doesn't support conditions at the time of the hearing, that argument?
Not now or for the reasonably foreseeable future able to parent the child. Well, neglect of parental duties, that finding would conform with neglect of parental duties.
And it would appear to be, I mean, we may agree that these are skinnier findings than you might see in different places, but that relates to the time, the conditions as they exist at the time of the hearing, right? It's using the word now seems to directly address that concern. So what should we do with that?
I mean, my concern is that the evidence presented, the guardian, look, I'm not faulting the district court for finding that the testimony provided at the trial was credible. And I see the court's argument that this does address conditions that exist at the time of the trial.
I mean, because the other side of that is if the transcript says that the social worker was unable to have any meaningful contact with father, then that finding that he's not now able to parent, the child, would seem to have a reasonable basis in the record, right? I mean, we have a finding that the conditions in the petition are true, and we have a finding that basically nothing's happened since the petition was filed because no one can get in contact with dad, and then we have a finding that he's not now able to parent the child. So why doesn't, as even acknowledging that that might be thinner factual findings than you might see somewhere else, why can't we just connect those dots and say these are not clearly erroneous findings of fact and they support the district court's conclusions of law?
Well, I think finding 9 is a clear, to be clear, I still think finding 9 is a clearly erroneous finding of fact. Where I think I got it wrong is that whether finding 9 is a clearly erroneous finding of fact or not doesn't necessarily negate the argument that the district court's findings fail to adequately address the statutory criteria, and that finding 10 by itself, in and of itself, I can generously say that that may address neglect of parental duties. It doesn't hash out how father is palpably unfit to parent.
We only need one basis to affirm, right?
And I'm arguing that this court should remand for proper findings where father gets to know why it is. Why is this a prejudicial error? It's an error because the petition is not proven by virtue of him not showing up. Father got served with this petition by publication, right? He got notice of the fact that the petition was filed, and I'm not saying that the facts are glowing in his favor. However, does he get to know what the reasoning is? Does he get to understand why it is that his rights to his children no longer exist? Because in reading this order, I wouldn't be able to figure that out. And the difference, one of the differences between us, is that I actually have access to the petition. So I'm able to look at why it was that we got here. Whereas in reading this order, knowing that father wasn't personally served the petition, or at least my review of the record is he was served notice of the petition by publication, does he get to know what happened?
Ms. Carlson, can I ask, what I'm trying to understand is what didn't happen here that did happen in the facts of HGD, where we know that a petition itself doesn't need to be separately offered in evidence as long as a witness testifies that it's accurate, which is exactly what we have here. And I see it looks like you were part of the amicus in that case, so you're familiar with it. Would you be able to help me understand what was missing here that was present there?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, I understood HGD, you know, a CHIPS petition is a different bar. It's both clear and convincing evidence, but it is a different bar and it is a different order. It has a substantially different effect on a family than a TPR petition. I mean, we're talking about a fundamental liberty interest that a person has in parenting their child, a constitutional right that is a little bit less burdensome for an agency to prove than whether or not there is a need for protection or services.
But did the Supreme Court make that distinction? I mean, there was nothing you could... I understand that point you're making, certainly. I don't think many would disagree, but in terms of the holding that was made in that decision seems to directly apply to our case, though it's a termination, correct?
I took the holding as him, rather, parent not showing up in HGD doesn't prove the petition. But considering the petition, are the facts in the allegation, or are the allegations in the petition proven? Which ones? I mean, the court can look at the petition and then tell me which allegations are proven, right? That would be a proper order. If you tell me which factual findings support which statutory basis, and this order, skinny that it is, does not tell me which factual findings support which statutory basis for termination. All it says is the facts in the petition were proven, and they clearly were not. The petition is long, the order is short, and the transcript is also very brief. Most of the facts in the petition were not proven by virtue of father not showing up, and that's what we get from HGD. A parent not showing up under the rules of juvenile protection procedure, as opposed to civil procedure, doesn't mean the facts are proven.
But isn't the basic difference that in this case someone testified that the facts alleged in the petition are true versus a lack of testimony in HDD? I mean, that's the key issue. So, I mean, and then, you know, the other part of that is you say the facts in the petition weren't proven, but yet you've also argued that you're not challenging the district court's decision to credit the testimony of the social worker, that all the facts in the petition are true. So in clearer review, is it reasonably supported? There's testimony in the record that the facts in the petition are true. Why isn't that enough? And why doesn't that distinguish this and make this, you know, distinguish this from HGD?
My understanding, and I'm often corrected, was that proving the facts in the petition is, you are still, regardless of having someone in the room testify to, I read the petition, it's true, you still hold the burden. The agency still has a burden of proving specific facts in the petition. By clear and convincing evidence would be having someone testify as to which facts are accurate. That would do it. But it was a very brief hearing with 22 pages of trial testimony where we did not elicit which facts were proven, and most of them were not. And because most of them were not, I'm asking this court to find that finding of fact number 9 is a clearly erroneous finding, not supported. May I finish my sentence?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. The finding of fact number 9 is a clearly erroneous finding. It is not supported by the record, which would be the petition, the trial transcript. The petition and the trial transcript in this file. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you have 15 minutes.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Arison Parkman. I'm Assistant Ramsey County Attorney appearing on behalf of the agency, Ramsey County Social Services Department. Ramsey County is respectfully requesting that this court uphold the district court decision and affirming the district court decision by finding that the district court did not abuse its discretion in finding that the Ramsey County petition was proven by clear and convincing evidence, find that the district court order was sufficient for effectuating review today, and also that the district court did not abuse its discretion when finding that the agency made reasonable efforts towards reunification. Alternatively, Ramsey County respectfully requests that Your Honors could also dismiss appellant's appeal because it was untimely filed.
Counsel, how do you respond to appellant's argument that while we as the court or you as lawyers may be able to look at the petition, look at the transcript, understand the basis on which the district court made this very weighty decision to terminate a father's parental rights, there's no way for father to understand that based on, you know, what I think we all have been probably accurately characterizing as a fairly skinny set, a limited set of findings. Aren't we right to be concerned by the brevity of this order?
Thank you, Your Honor. Certainly, yes, this case was a termination of parental rights order, which is different from the CHIPS petition adjudication in HGD. However, I would point the court to the fact that the applicable rules in HGD and here for parents failing to appear are the same, which is Rule 18 of the Juvenile Rules of Protection Procedure, which states that if a parent is properly served, which in this case, appellant was personally served on November 5th, 2024, appearing in court on that day, and fails to appear at the subsequent pretrial, which is what happened, the court may take evidence in support of the petition. In HGD and in a termination of parental rights petition, the burden of proof is the same, which is clear and convincing evidence. And so I would request that the court look to the fact that in HGD, the standard of proof was the same. Even though this...
Can I follow up with that a little bit? And this really goes to, I think, appellant's second issue of inability, that the order itself doesn't allow for effective appellate review. And I think we're all agreeing the skinny, and it might actually be a bit complimentary more than it was, because even a default, what we know from MGD, HGD, despite failure to appear, as you just point out, the burden is all true and the same, and it must create it's much akin, in my understanding, of a default and a custody modification or custody establishment. The moving party still has to prove the best interest, go through the factors, and the judge has to make findings on those. Why would this be any different than any type of an order we get where, while it's true the court found them credible, what we don't know is from the petition which part of what they found credible proved by clear and convincing evidence the termination ought to appear? And if it's not there, why ought we not remand for further findings to establish that?
Thank you, Your Honor. The specifics of what the court based its decision on is in the testimony that's provided by both witnesses at the default hearing. The transcript shows that there was unrefuted testimony that the court found on that day that both witnesses were credible, that based on the testimony provided, that the petition had been proven by clear and convincing evidence. And if you look at the order, that's what's reflected. Findings 6 and 7 indicate that both of the witnesses provided credible testimony and that it supported the petition as well as the best interest to terminate appellant's rights. In addition, as has already been noted, finding 10 speaks to the fact that appellant is not likely now or in the future, foreseeable future, to be able to parent, as is finding 8, which speaks to the basis for being able to terminate a child that has been neglected in foster care for a certain period of time. But I would point to the record that was in the transcript that even the testimony alone that was given by the social worker and guardian ad litem is sufficient to find that the petition was proven by clear and convincing evidence.
Can I follow up with a hypothetical? Let's assume he showed up. I'm assuming you'd have more testimony and longer period of time, and we received this order. How is that different? In other words, we got more pages of transcript. Is your point, is there legal authority you can cite us to that we can imply the necessary factual findings, for instance, as to the statutory basis from the record itself?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would submit that certainly if appellant had shown up for the trial, which when the last pretrial that he appeared for, he requested a continued pretrial for December 10th, as well as trial dates, which did take place for the mother. His attorney appeared at both the pretrial on December 10th that he failed to appear for, as well as the first day of trial on February 3rd. He could have appeared at trial. He could have filed a post-trial motion after this default was entered. His attorney was properly served with this motion. He did none of those things. Certainly, if this had gone to trial, if he had showed up on the day of trial, there would have been a longer order with more findings based on any other evidence that he might have submitted. I would note for the record, his attorney...
But my hypothetical is if there was not. What I'm getting at is... Is there a difference in terms of how we can imply findings when there's a default versus a contested trial?
Thank you. Yes, I would submit that there is a difference in that, as has been discussed, just because a parent doesn't show up, it does not mean that the petition is proven and that the petition is submitted. The default rules under Rule 1801 and 1802, as well as the guidance in HGD, specifically state that with testimony in support of the petition, and if that testimony is consistent with what's in the petition, the court may find that parent in default and order what is requested in the hearing. That is very different from what happens at trial when actual evidence is submitted and objected to and ultimately admitted by the court versus hearing testimony and the court making all of its findings at the end of the default hearing, which is reflected in the transcript. The judge found that this was proven by clear and convincing evidence, accepted both testimony of the social worker and the guardian, found that it was in the best interest to terminate the parental rights.
Did the judge actually find that this was proven by clear and convincing evidence in the transcript?
Your Honor, I believe that in the transcript, the requested findings that were made by the county and were that to accept the evidence or the testimony from both workers to find that the termination should occur as in the best interest of the child and that the petition had been proven. I don't know that the specific words for clear and convincing evidence were stated, but I would note that it is of special importance that the judge specifically asked, does anyone have any objections? There were no objections, including from appellant's attorney. Further,
I mean, it's not appellant's attorney's burden to make sure that there's an adequate record on which the district court can make this order. And I mean, I guess my concern is, where's the line between us implying findings and then us actually making findings, which we can't do? Because if I mean, looking at the transcript, there really aren't any specific findings. The court basically says the state's requests are granted in their entirety. And the request that was made right before that was simply to find father in default. And then find that the termination of parental rights is in the child's best interests. And then a reasonable efforts finding. And there's no statutory basis. It's not, there wasn't a request to make a finding about the specific bases to order the termination of parental rights. So I think it might be a little different if we're looking at a transcript in which the court, or at least the court, granted a request that was robust and addressed all of the findings of fact that would support the statutory basis to terminate parental rights. But that's not this case, unless I'm missing any of the transcript, right?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would note that Rule 18.02 states that if the petition is found to be proven, the court may order the relief granted in the petition. And so even though the court specifically didn't make that finding, the court also didn't make the finding that now or that the father is likely now or in the foreseeable future to be able to parent the child. Some of these findings are in the course of the court drafting its order, taking in account the testimony from the social worker and the guardian, and making the ultimate finding that it is in the best interest to terminate this parent's parental rights based on what the court heard that day from the testimony from both the social worker and guardian about where that father was at that day and time in terms of his lack of case plan compliance, failing to visit with the children, and his general refusal to engage with the agency throughout the pendency of the case.
All that may be true. I guess my concern here is that there's not a statutory basis, really, I guess, other than the substantially, continuously, repeatedly refusing and neglecting to comply with the duties and the conclusion of law one. But you know that it's just not a very robust record in the transcript, and the order is so short that it's just a little concerning. So I don't know if you want to address that.
Certainly, and understanding that the record and order may be thin, I would note that, again, this was a default hearing where the father failed to show up. He also failed to file any...
My more articulate way of asking my question. The default procedure doesn't excuse the court from making the statutorily required findings, right? I mean, there's no case that says that. I mean, in fact, it's HGD suggests to the contrary.
Your Honor, HGD states that the district court may consider the allegations in the petition if the evidence presented establishes the reliability of those allegations. So the holding in HGD, in my reading, is that when you have unrefuted testimony, as was in HGD and as was in this case, and it is consistent with the allegations in the petition, the court then can consider the allegations in the petition. Included in that petition are the statutory bases. We might not have addressed each one of those on the record, but what's reflected in the court's order does reflect those statutory bases about not being able to parent now or in the foreseeable future, the fact that the children have been in out-of-home placement for 2 years, which meets the statutory base for a child that is neglected in foster care, the fact that the court made reasonable or that the agency made reasonable efforts towards reunification. Even while the testimony may be brief, the court should consider the fact that from the time that this case opened throughout the pendency of the case, the father in this case refused to engage with the agency. There is testimony from the guardian ad litem that he did not believe he needed to do anything in this case, that both she and the social worker attempted to meet with him multiple times to jointly create his case plan, and he did not believe he needed to do that. He refused to sign it, and he refused to engage in the case plan. Even though the agency continued to reach out to appellant throughout the case, the agency cannot force him to comply. And so at a certain point, there was not much more for either witness to state on the record beyond the fact that they had made these efforts and he neglected and refused to comply with what the court ordered him to do in his case plan.
Counsel, if I understand, if I best understand your argument about HGD and default versus a contested hearing, is there's kind of this middle area as you read HGD, and that is we reject in the juvenile cases the civil standard that will presume it to be true, but it's not much more. As long as a witness says everything is true, basically, and we this order would be sufficient because we just look at the petition, and as long as we can dig out of there sufficient allegation, so that's kind of that second tier versus a contested hearing where we would have to have findings on all the statutory requirements.
Correct. And in HGD, certainly the whole petition was not testified to at that default hearing. Not every single fact or statutory basis. There is very limited testimony that's included in that order from the two social workers that testified in that case. And I would point to the testimony provided in this default hearing speaks to all the main issues that are outlined in the petition, that father failed to consistently visit, failed to provide any UAs throughout the case, failed to address his history of domestic violence with the mother by continuing to live with her. All of those main issues are provided in the testimony given in the default hearing, which are consistent with what's in the petition. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
For the record, Ann Morris Carlson, and I represent appellant father F.F. I apologize to this court and counsel that in my reply brief, I did have a bit of a word processing error as I attempted to flesh out a response to the argument that this court can now dismiss my appeal after finding that it was timely filed because the notice of filing order was not properly served on counsel. This court cannot consider evidence that is outside the trial record pursuant to Minnesota Rules of Civil Appellate Procedure 110.01. So the court cannot consider the affidavit of Kathy Eilers in determining that this is an untimely appeal.
Counsel, let me just take you back to the issue of the order. I don't know that HGD necessarily speaks to the concern that we're discussing today, which is about the adequacy of the findings that the district court made in its order. So is there a case you could point us to, default proceeding or contested, where we or the Supreme Court have found this sort of light level of findings in a TPR case insufficient?
The court is asking me about the standard of review. I mean, you're asking me to cite a specific case, and I can tell you the standard of review. To adequately effectuate appellate review, the order must provide insight into which facts and opinions were most persuasive of the ultimate decision. In re welfare of MM, 452 Northwest 2nd, 236 Minnesota, 1990. Appellate courts are limited to whether the findings address the statutory criteria and are supported by substantial evidence and are clearly erroneous. CDG 558 Northwest 2nd 481. Do the findings address the statutory criteria? No. The standard of review requires this court to start there. Do the findings address the statutory criteria? They do not. Are they supported by substantial evidence and are not clearly erroneous? There's some disagreement among the minds here as to whether or not they're supported by substantial evidence. And I stand by the fact that two of them are clearly erroneous, because even in making the argument today, counsel cites to a number of findings that aren't supported by trial testimony. Findings about domestic violence, we didn't talk about that at the trial. We didn't talk about the efforts that were made by the agency other than, you know, the last social worker issued had a case plan and the guardian thought it was sufficient.
But are those allegations contained in the petition, which by virtue of the testimony at the hearing have now the district court found to be credible by clear and convincing evidence?
Which was error. That was error for the court to find that the petition was proven by clear and convincing evidence. Some of the petition may have been. I have to guess as to which parts of it were, but I'm certain that not all of it was. And that when we talk about the children being in the hospital, no one testified to that. I mean, we still have a burden of clear and convincing evidence, right? That continues to be the burden that is on the petitioner. The agency has to prove allegations in its petition by clear and convincing evidence, which is more than a preponderance, meaning more than some.
But would you agree, counsel, again, that seems to be what HGD is allows for, and it does, the bottom line is the default situation is different than the contested hearing, and that the end result of HGD, it's the risk you take of not appearing. So it's more than the civil standard, but it's obviously going to be less contested as it was here when you don't show up.
We still need an order that contains findings that conform with the statute.
And that's your issue two.
That's issue two.
Which is kind of a separate.
Issue one, yeah, I mean, going through the standard of review, and one of the mistakes I made in my brief is that actually this court gives a de novo review to interpretation of the rules of juvenile protection procedure, but I addressed it from the standpoint of a clearly erroneous factual finding. That's the argument I properly put before this court. Finding 9 is a clearly erroneous finding. However you get there, him not showing up doesn't prove the petition. There is still a burden. There is still a burden on the agency to prove specific facts, and there is still a requirement of the court to issue an order that contains specific facts. May I finish my thought?
Yes, go ahead.
There is still a requirement on the court that it issue an order that contains specific facts that would allow father to know why it is that he has lost his parental rights. And this order is insufficient. And very briefly, the order is an insufficient replacement for a proper notice of filing order, which I addressed in my reply brief.
Thank you.
Seeing
no further questions, thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments in this case. The matter has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion within the statutory time frame. And that concludes our oral arguments for this morning.